pay off debts, go into severe debt, get a second job, pay it off, gamble while you're doing it, get a win, pay off some debt, endless cycle, lying, cheating, stealing, gambling for 6 to 8 hours a day, skipping classes. If I went out with friends, being distracted the whole time, checking on scores, flew to Paris, and within 2 hours, I was on the toilet of the hotel spinning a slot on my phone. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the One Day at a Time podcast. Today, we're doing something a little bit different. I have a guest, Christina from the Broke Girl Society, on today to actually be the one giving the interview, and I will be the interviewee. So, Christina, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. I feel so honored to be able to do this. I love turning the mic on, like, podcaster and things like that, because we spend so much of our time, you know, interviewing others. Pieces of our story have come out, and you've shared quite a bit about your story. But sometimes, you know, being interviewed by another podcaster on your own show is just fun.
100%. And hopefully we dive into some topics that we haven't quite covered.
And I think what's interesting with both of us and both of our stories is that we're friends in this space, right? But we're two very different people. I am in my mid-40s. I live in the Midwest southern part. My story of gambling was from about 28 to 42. And you are a young fella from the East Coast, mid-20s. And it's just so interesting how different our stories are, but yet how similar the behaviors and how gambling impacted just our path in life. Let's just go ahead and kind of start this with growing up. Did you have like memories of gambling around your family, or like was it something that was kind of you were used to?
I have some early memories of gambling in the family. Nothing that I viewed as problematic. Even looking back, it feels a little bit of a stretch to make it sound problematic, but it was there. It was little card games with like my great aunt at some of her family parties, you know, 5-card poker, but we were playing for like candies or even for free. But that was an early introduction that was happening from, you know, age 10, I would say. Then what I think pops out more in my head is trips to Atlantic City. Growing up in South Jersey, we were about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on traffic, to the casinos in Atlantic City. And my parents were people that would, you know, they'd play every once in a while. But when we would go and it was like me, my brother, my mom and dad, they really wouldn't gamble. But that's where all the good restaurants were in the area at the time. So we would drive over to get like that family style Italian at, I can't even remember the name of the place now. Good, because they're not sponsoring this podcast. Being around the slot machines, being around the casino floor, which was inevitable. And anyone that's been to a casino knows that if you want to eat, you got to walk by some slot machines. It was just felt like that looks really cool. I can't wait until I can do that. And that was at age 8, 9, 10 years old that I was having those thoughts. They're playing video games is what I thought. These look awesome. I can't wait to do it myself.
That's interesting because I always worry about here in Oklahoma, casino gambling didn't really show up until the early 2000s. And now you can't hardly go through the state without seeing a casino on the corner, but they really advertise it at these big family entertainment facilities like Windstar, you know, down on our Texas border. And I always wondered, you know, what kids would think kind of walking through there. I really thought it was going to be something similar to what you shared. So,
you know, what's pretty interesting within that is like Oklahoma has the highest rate of gambling addiction prevalence in the United States. Do you think that it's a result of the casinos being like newer? Because the Jersey casinos came in the 70s. So by the time I was going, you know, they were around for 30 years plus. Do you think that the rate is correlated to the fact that gambling's newer there? And will we see that in other states?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a very different dynamic than like the East Coast, where gambling has been pretty prevalent for years. Whereas, you know, it is something newer, a newer attraction here in Oklahoma. What I think has a lot to do with it too, is a lot of these casinos are up in areas where there's not a lot to do. It's so spread out, and these casinos are tribal. And so they put these casinos in like out of the way areas. So it's like most small towns don't, there's not a lot to do on a Saturday night. And so gambling is the one kind of big attraction. You know, they do it to where they can bring shows and things in. So I think that that's a piece of it as well. But I think, yeah, it's something new, something interesting.
That's so opposite to like Vegas, which has been deemed the entertainment capital of the world, where there's endless things to do. The casinos are a side thing, even though it's what people go there for. But yeah, that's a really interesting point, is like, are people in rural areas more susceptible to gambling, maybe gambling problems because they're bored? I don't know.
That's a good point. And something hopefully they'll continue to kind of discover. Okay. So you kind of had, you know, familiarity with gambling as younger. And then when did your gambling like really kind of start for you?
the formal gambling started when I was 18, but by the time I was in early high school, I would say, so maybe 14, 15 years old, I was hitting puberty. And so I have a little brother, he's 4 years younger than me. And at the time that I was kind of growing rapidly, we'll say, he was not. When we were growing up, we'd play baseball, hockey, like soccer outside. And it was fun because we were both little guys. So there wasn't like much room for one being better than the other. We were, even though he's 4 years younger, I hadn't hit a growth spurt yet, games were even. By the time I was in high school, there was such a disparity between our athleticism because he was feeling so much younger than me now, that I was basically giving him lines on games in order to motivate him to play. And we weren't playing for money, but it was like, hey, Jake, I want to play hockey today. He's like, no, you always win. I'm like, okay, well, let's play to 11 and you can start winning by 5. And then he'd be like, oh, okay, now it's fair. So I was basically offering lines to my little brother when I was 14 or 15. And then at a certain point in high school as well, I guess, they became for money, $5, $10. And I would never pay him if he won. I would take his, but I would never pay him if he won. But then, you know, the first formal experience with like legal gambling that we all know and we see on the commercials every day was daily fantasy sports when I was 18 years old. And that was, you know, senior year of high school. My friends and I, we grew up near Philly, so we'd watch the Philly sports teams together every night, basically, that we hung out. Same with my family. We'd watch the games when they were on. So this idea of, hey, you can make money while you're watching the games you're already watching, made it feel more fun, skin in the game. It gave me a sense of proving how much I knew about sports, because I thought the more I knew, the better chance I would have at making money on what was essentially glorified sports betting. That, of course, didn't happen. And right away, when that was happening, my friends would put their bets in on the 7 o'clock games. Then the Phillies game would end and it'd be 10 o'clock. They would say, okay, going to sleep because we got to get up at 5 in the morning or whatever time they made us get up for school. I would stay up gambling on the 10 o'clock games and the West Coast contests. And then when it became regular sports betting soon after, that became the 12:30 Hawaii versus Boise State games, playing in Honolulu. And so I would find myself gambling like 3 to 4 times more than everyone else around me when I was 18.
Interesting. And just a quick side note, what was the weirdest thing you found yourself betting on?
Back in the days before I started doing regular sports betting, or overall?
Just overall, like what is the most random thing you found yourself? Did you question it at the time?
I think that there were times where I gambled on like really random, weird sports, but one that was always consistently present, even after it should have been, which is an excuse in itself, but it was Korean baseball. When COVID happened, there was no sports to bet on, but the first league to reopen was the KBO, which is the Korean Baseball Organization. I think there's 20 teams or so. The ESPN was picking up coverage because there was literally nothing else on. Their games would start at like 1 in the morning and I would stay up all night gambling on them. But then I kept gambling on them years after because I thought I knew about the league now, right? Like, oh, I've been betting on this since COVID. I can come out with the win. So yes, I know a lot about the Kiwoom Heroes and the NC Dino from the KBO, unfortunately.
That's interesting because it's like in all the conversations I've had, sometimes people will say, man, I found myself betting on like some type of rooster race or something in the overseas in the middle of the night. And it's like, at what point were, did you ever kind of question that? You know, all these things that kind of seem a little irrational, like as a gambler, you can just make them feel rational. Yeah, it's totally fine to be betting on this random thing that really has no bearing on anything.
As a sports bettor, you can almost strip down the sport itself and just look at the numbers. Because when you take something like rooster fighting, right? Like, I don't know. I've never bet on rooster fighting, as a disclaimer. But if the odds of the game are minus 110, you know what your chances of winning are. You're theoretically a favorite. So it doesn't matter what's actually happening. You're at a certain point just playing numbers against numbers. And that's what led me to bet a lot on tennis. I didn't really even watch the matches that were playing. I would swipe up on my phone to refresh the score, of course, because I was compulsive with it. But it didn't matter who was playing. It only mattered what the odds were because you knew what their theoretical chance of winning was. So it was just a proposition at the end of the day.
Interesting. And see, I think it's always so fascinating to me when I talk to you about this because you're a numbers guy. You have a very analytical way of looking at your gambling behaviors, right? And I think that probably most sports bettors and that type of gambling, like that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. You have to have an understanding of that. But me as a slot player, like that's the only thing I ever gambled on. It was never about any of that. I never even thought about the odds of me being able to win at this machine.
We're like desperate as problem gamblers to explain away the fault from our own decisions. And so when it's something like this slot machine was rigged, the casino was watching me, they knew I won yesterday, so they didn't let me win today. No, the game is rigged, like you just said, Christina, because you're not supposed to win in the long run as you play it. But it's not like magical, like Ocean's 11 type rigged against you where it's like they're watching you and waiting for you to get excited and then they're going to pull the cord on you. That's not true. It doesn't have to be true. They're still going to win.
You know, when I first entered recovery, yeah, I was super angry at the operators in the industry thinking, oh, they did this to me. And it was not until I entered recovery that I realized, no, I did this to myself. When did gambling really start to kind of impact your life? And I think this is a really good question because gambling started so early for you that one of the biggest overall issues with sports gambling and online gambling is that you start gambling and it starts kind of messing up your course of life, right? You've got this course mapped out for you, these things that you want for yourself, college, all these things. And then gambling kind of shows up and, you know, it's sending a lot of people off course. So when did it kind of start to show up for you?
That course, that predefined course, we're taught in school mostly to go get good grades, meet with your guidance counselor, and then figure out what school you can go to. Or maybe if you want to go to a trade school, go to there. There's always a next tangible step. And it never felt to me like I chose what my next step was until I started gambling. I did well in school and I got into a nice college. That was like supposed to be celebrated as intelligence. That was the best next step for me, supposedly. And then when I got there, all I wanted to do was gamble. And that's really where, going back to your original question, when did it pick up, start to affect my life, was early college. I was now, I'm living on my own. I had a little bit of money that I had won from gambling in high school, some early wins that fed into that false belief that it would happen again. I basically ignored the majority of things happening freshman year of college in terms of socializing, developing the friend groups that would last the next couple of years, joining clubs, even going to classes, because I was more focused on gambling because my family and life and my teachers and community chose school for me in my head. You know, I really could have used my own free will, but whatever. Gambling was my choice. And so I thought to myself, if I can just figure this gambling thing out, I don't have to stay on this path that's been chosen for me anymore. And I can remember where it came to like the first really bad problem was when UMBC beat Virginia in the March Madness tournament of, that would have been March of 2018. And so that was the first time that a 16 seed beat a 1 seed in the college basketball tournament, which that tournament's been happening forever. Like I'd probably guess like over 100 years. I said to myself, you should have known that was going to happen. How did you not know that they were going to beat them? Virginia's a fraud team. Like this was the kind of stuff I was saying. And then I said, okay, you didn't put money on that. That was incredibly frustrating. You should have known, would have been a great payout. Take them the next game. There's no way they lose to the 9 seed, which was Kansas State. And then I think Kansas State beat them by like 12 or 13 points. What I had done was I had taken the full balance I had available with the bookie, which was more money than I had. I could not pay it back. That was the first time I went into gambling debt. From that point, I kind of went on this spiral where right in March, it was baseball's exhibition games, like March, spring training into April. And I was betting all the credit on every game that I bet on. And we're talking about exhibition baseball. We're talking about like players that will be in single A minor league, like really low level minor league, or maybe even get cut from the team going against each other. And that's what I was gambling on. And I lost that full credit line. And that was the first time I had to tell my family that I gambled too much, is what I said. I made a mistake. I gambled too much. I need help paying this off.
What was their response to that?
They just thought I was stupid. They said, well, that was a stupid decision. We'll give you a loan. You can pay us back instead of the bookie. Close the account and move on. I think the reasoning behind that was pure, but it was treating it, which I think a lot of people do that don't understand gambling addiction, was treating it as a mathematical problem. He owes money. We pay the money. The problem's gone. Well, that's one of the problems. The other problem was that as soon as they paid that money, I picked up a second job when I went home for the summer, and I worked to pay them back, but I was gambling on the side to try to speed up that income and get it back. Because now I didn't have a debt except to my family, and they weren't going to, you know, shoot me in the leg. They're just going to bother me once a week for my payment.
Interesting. And I want to kind of recognize the parallel when you were saying about feeling like something you were controlling, you were able to control when you felt like the rest of your life wasn't really your choice. I can connect with that parallel for my own gambling, right? I have even said, I think gambling for me felt like it was the only thing I could control when my life felt so out of control outside of it. And I think it's like now hindsight, recovery, all this work, it's like, no, I was being very much controlled by my gambling. But I can just connect with that feeling like this is the one thing that I'm doing for me. Good or bad, it still felt like the one thing that I had control over. Like I could choose to go and do this. I often refer to it as like a relationship that is abusive. Like you go into it, there's a lot of love bombing at first. You know, you can look at that as like all the free play and all the things that they give you, a lot of, hey, come to us, you know, we'll give you all these things. I primarily work with women in the space. This really kind of relates to a lot of us. And we get into this relationship with our gambling and it feels really good at first, right? Lots of good things happening. And then it starts to have these small things start to kind of deteriorate and toxicity starts to kind of show up and you love the gambling, but it's killing you. Moving forward, you found yourself home from college. You've already been in debt. You've worked yourself out of it. What continued to happen for you?
I picked up a third job and I was driving Chinese food. During those days, if you've ever been a delivery driver of any kind, anyone listening, there's like days where you'll go and work and like no one orders any food or like hours at a time and you're just sitting there. And so I was sitting there just staring at the table. I was like, I shouldn't gamble, but I'm going to. And I would start placing little bets. I got a new bookie and I started placing bets and I was betting on a website called Bovada. And I would then get an order to go and drop off. But while I was doing it, I would be watching the game that I bet on. So I was literally like driving a car like this, like just looking at my phone for 4 years, basically was what I ended up doing it for. I was losing more money during those shifts than I was making. So I was basically driving around all day, sitting around all day, wasting time, literally ending up with less money than I started. And it brought on this pattern of feeling depressed, which I thought would be broken by going back to school for the second year after that summer. But really, I just kept doing the same things, gambling for 6 to 8 hours a day, skipping classes. If I went out with friends, being distracted the whole time, checking on scores. And people always ask, like, how did you have enough money to keep floating this? Well, there were wins. There were days where I would get paid from the jobs I was working. I worked on campus. The money just kind of went up and down, but always trended downwards. Then I met the girl that I would date for the next 3 years. Yeah, it was really just endless gambling. And then it was right around that time that I decided I need to make a big change. I'm going to go for a semester abroad. And I chose Australia, which 10 people listening might have just groaned. Like, oh my God, I can't believe you did that.
I just did inwardly. And I like, just because I've seen such an impact gambling has down in Australia.
Yeah, it's the highest rate of gambling addiction in the world, as far as I know. I was by myself, completely isolated from friends, family, girlfriend. And I flew from Philly to San Francisco, San Francisco to Sydney, roughly like 22 hours, I think, with the layovers. Instead of going to sleep or doing anything like that, it was like 5 in the morning. I went directly to the Star Casino in Sydney. It was walking distance from the hostel that I would stay at for the next couple months. And I started playing poker.
So was this something that you did because you were feeling lonely or isolated? Or was this something you were choosing this isolation so that you could continue this behavior?
From the moment that I landed, I wanted to go and gamble. So like I wasn't lonely 5 minutes after landing. Within a couple of weeks, there was definitely a feeling of loneliness. I lived with a group of guys. There was somehow 8 of us in the same like apartment area. They were really cool, but they were all from Indiana University and they were all in the same frat. So even though they were friendly with me, I was like the outsider guy. And so I was like, all right, well, you guys are going to go out to the bars. What am I going to gain? I have my girlfriend. I don't really want to go. I want to go to the casino. Like that's where I feel the best. And so I kind of self-isolated myself to a certain extent. The types of gambling I was doing at home always felt like I have to hide this from the majority of people because it's technically illegal. Whereas in Australia, it was like, oh yeah, everyone around's gambling. I see 100 people in this bar. They're all gambling on this like fight that's happening at 10 a.m. because we're in Australia and American sports happen at 9, 10 in the morning. So let's go to the bar and drink and gamble on it. So it felt more communal.
Kind of moving forward, you come back. When is it that you kind of really started to acknowledge that gambling is impacting your life? It's taking you off course, all of those things. When did that kind of start to happen for you?
Maybe 2 years later. So I came back and it was COVID. And that was when all the sports turned off. So I came back and I was 21. And the only thing that was open at this point was the online casino and poker. So I started playing Poker Stars. It was in New Jersey. So it was like one of the states where they can operate online poker tournaments, had some early wins with that, convinced myself that it was a different form of gambling, which I think the large majority of my audience has done as well, that I could beat, I could figure it out, I could study it. And I did endlessly study it. It's just gambling though. So you eventually catch the losses if you keep playing for long enough, pay off debts, go into severe debt, get a second job, pay it off, gamble while you're doing it, get a win, pay off some debt, endless cycle, lying, cheating, stealing. This was right around the time where I said, I want to make a business. I want to be an entrepreneur. And so I came up with this cryptocurrency-based basketball social media site. It was so niche. It was like the most niche business, but I took on investment because that's what you do when you start a business, right? You take on investment. That's what I thought. So I might have my family give me money, some of my friends, and then this guy that was more of an acquaintance. Basically, as soon as they all paid me, I gambled it because I was not necessarily trying to steal from them. But I told myself, if I double it, I can pay their investments back and then I can start this business with what's left, like that kind of belief. And so then 2 weeks later, they're all like, all right, where's the business? I'm like, it doesn't exist yet. Okay, where's my money? It doesn't exist anymore. That was a couple months before I think things hit their peak. I was basically committing crimes, if you want to. I guess that's technically a crime, though I can't imagine my mom suing me. So it was definitely deceptive, if not a crime. The things really got bad right around that time, and it bled into February of 2023. And I had some big wins in January. All the debts were paid back. Everyone was good. We were all square, and I had money left over. And I was like, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for, even though I was down a godforsaken, unknown amount lifetime. I had money. And now I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Paris and I'm going to meet up with this girl that I was talking to at the time from Romania. So we're going to meet in the middle. And I flew to Paris and within 2 hours, maybe, I was on the toilet of the hotel spinning a slot on my phone, some French slot. It was in French. I don't even know what it was. And I paused after I lost all my money and I was staring at the screen and I had this thought. You gambled so that you could be the man, travel the world, do whatever you wanted to. You reached that end goal and you got to come to Paris using money you won gambling. The whole trip's paid for by your gambling. Why are you still doing it? What is the purpose if it's not what you said it was? And that was the first time that I said, I think I can't stop myself from gambling because it always had an excuse before, but now I have what I supposedly wanted and I couldn't stop. So there was no excuse anymore. And that's when I decided to get some help. So I came back and I went to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting. Things go well for 8 months, actually. I reached this point where now I'm living in Philadelphia with a group of my friends. I got a second job to try to build up my finances again. I'm out of debt after, you know, maybe 4 months after that. I'm working, I'm stacking up a decent amount of money, nothing crazy, but like for where I was living, for what my expenses were, I was doing good. I told myself after that 8 months, like, damn, your life is boring. There's not much that you're doing that matters. This job sucks. You're doing the same thing every day. What's to enjoy? And then after a couple of days of that, I realized something, that when I first quit gambling on February 8th of 2022, I was living in New Jersey. And in March of that year, I moved to Pennsylvania. So I did my self-exclusion from the casinos, which is banning yourself from playing there in New Jersey, but not Pennsylvania. And after 8 months, it took me 8 months to realize that, but eight months, I go, huh, I'm feeling bored. I'm feeling sorry for myself. I have a bunch of money and I can gamble because I'm not banned from it here. The Eagles are playing today. And then that day happened. I would spend 12 hours in a casino on a gambling binge of pretty much everything, losing enough money that it put me into debt for the next 6 months, working 70 to 80 hours a week. It was 3 credit cards maxed out on cash advances.
You've entered recovery. You've got your last bet date. What made you want to like help people in such a broad way? Like when I entered, there were a handful of podcasts doing recovery. They were male dominated. And I wanted to bring kind of my own perspective and voice into it. Podcasts helped me so much in recovery, and that's kind of the direction I went. But you kind of came in at a really different angle with the social media. Anonymity is still such a huge thing because there's still so much stigma and shame attached to gambling addiction, especially for women, but just in general, right? And here you are, this young kid out there using these platforms. I'm a Gen X. Social media is not, you and I have conversations about social media all the time. It is not my thing. It is not my friend. I try my best. If you see an awkward social media of me out there, just know that I tried my best. But like you, here you are, you're just doing so much and you're helping so many people. What made you say, yep, this is the way I want to go?
Well, when I got back into recovery on November the 12th, 2022, I went about 2 weeks just in that back in that same pattern that I was in before of just like, yeah, I'm just going to not gamble. Like life sucks and it's boring, but I'm just not going to gamble. And then everything will be fine. And then this guy that was closer in age to me stopped showing up to our meetings. And I was like, all right, that's weird. Like, let me give him a call. And I'm like about to clock in for my second shift. Like I would spend the next 6 months paying down debt. And I gave him a call and I said, hey, what happened? Did you gamble? And he said, yeah. And I said, what happened? He said, breakup, went back to it, felt sorry for myself. You know, one of the usual reasons that people might used to go back to gambling and recovery. And I said, oh, well, dude, I can tell you one thing. That is a terrible idea because I'm about to work again. I just worked 8 hours. Now I'm about to work 8 hours. And it was like expressing how like shitty my situation was, I think, that kind of stopped him from continuing down that path while he still had a little bit of money left in the tank. And he came back into the meetings. And I wouldn't say it was solely me. He had to make that decision himself, of course, but like part of what I said to him, even just expressing how terrible my situation was, might have helped him to reach that conclusion faster. And I said like, oh, okay. Well, that felt good. I feel good about that. Like, let me just do it again. And I recorded it and put it on YouTube. That was it. It was just, let me do it again. No one watched it. Like literally zero. This is going on my channel. So if someone wants to go right now and scroll back to the very first YouTube video, I think maybe it's hit 1,000 views. All of them came like at least a year after it was published. I think maybe 20 people watched it the first year, including my mom, myself, and Shreya, my girlfriend. So Shreya tells me, hey, your video sucked after I put it out. And I was like, oh, thanks. That's a great thing for you to say. Very motivating. She said, no. Make it more exciting and put it on TikTok. And at this point, I think I had like a couple dozen pictures in my phone. Like I never took pictures. I never recorded anything because I think a lot of guys can probably relate to that. Younger guys just like, yeah, we don't care to take pictures and stuff. I was like, TikTok, like that's for kids who dance. Like, I don't even have any videos. She said, just record what you said faster. Hold a microphone, which was so stupid because it wasn't attached to anything. It was just a microphone I was holding that ran a cord off camera. So you can tell if you listened to it earlier on as well. But I did that. And then I sped the video up and put a green screen of a roulette wheel behind me. That one was recorded in the drive-thru of a Dunkin' Donuts. And it did like 1.3 mil on views. I was like, all right, half the people are making fun of me, but there's something to this. Like, I'm gonna keep posting on this platform. And pretty much just started posting 6 times a day. It really just stemmed from an accident of feeling good after doing something nice.
Well, I'm glad you did that, though. Like, yeah. Look at the impact that you've had. Look at the people that you're helping. One of the things that I want to say, and I don't normally go in and read the comments, even on the one that I did, which is doing really well. I take it personally. If somebody wants to make fun of me or something like that, I'm like, oh, that's hurtful. I don't want to read that anymore. On what you did, one with my friend Tara, who is absolutely amazing. If you find her podcast and find her work, she's fantastic. And so I went in and I read the comments because we were kind of talking about it. And one of the comments that said, and I've seen this quite a bit, is that when people find these podcasts and they're in this, their moments of kind of, they're really not feeling great. They're struggling. They're not seeing the hope. They're not feeling the happiness. And they see like you and I or Tara and some of these other people sharing their stories and they're kind of laughing. You know, they're in such a different place than they were in those moments of their story. And people are like, well, this is hard for me to hear. You guys are happy and you guys are laughing about something. And it's like, how do you respond to those types of things? Like for me, it's like, I was where you were. It was so hard to see people a year in recovery and they were actually happy and smiling. But here's the whole point of that. Like you can be there too. This is what's waiting for you. Like right now you're struggling and you're feeling it and you're overwhelmed and all these things. But watching these interviews and things like that, you know, you're 2 years in recovery. I'm almost 4 years in recovery. And it's like life is very different for us today. How do you stay connected to that? How do you respond to those kinds of comments?
Before responding to that exact comment, what I generally try to do now, given that there's like a larger quantity of feedback than there was in the beginning, is I try to bundle them into themes in my head. Theme one, trolling, pretty much just ignore. Theme two, like a strong misunderstanding of their abilities in gambling. That's a group that you can target to really try to make content for, even if they're mad at you for doing it. Like the sports bettors that have unrealistic expectations, you tell them that you suck, but six months later, they come back, they say you're right. So that's a whole different category. Then there's the positive feedback. That's always fun to interact with. When it comes to what you're referring to with Tara, basically, we saw comments to the extent of you're having too much fun, you're inauthentic, this guest isn't taking this seriously. And these are kinds of comments that would come from someone that's in a dark place. Like you said, not necessarily understanding that what we're trying to show is what happens on the other side. When someone comes on a podcast like this, like we just did, I was reflecting on the moment things were happening, but that's also 7 to 8 years ago. So I'm reflecting on that, but I'm also giving you the other side of the coin by the end of the video. So if you're watching one of these and a guest is laughing, they should be laughing because that means they're in a better place in their journey. That doesn't mean that it's an attack on you, they're taking you and your situation less seriously. It's that their situation that was like yours happened before, and this is what can happen next. So you can empathize with people that are angry that you're happy because they want to be happy too. At the end of the day, you just got to be authentic. If your authenticity looks like inauthenticity to someone else, you can't really control that.
But I think it's just a valid point to kind of show like, this is what life looks like in recovery. It's like, it's not saying life is easy because there's hard stuff like in recovery, but we're actually facing these hard things. We're working through the emotions. We're figuring it out in the moment versus the avoidance and all of that, that addiction allowed us to kind of focus on. And so, but I can still remember, you know, exactly where I was March 6th of 2021, feeling like I did not want to wake up the next day. And, you know, even the weeks before that, thinking, how am I going to end my life? Anytime I talk about that moment, like I cry, like it's, I can go right back to that moment. That moment will never leave me. And I think that that's what continues to move me forward, continues to keep me in recovery. And I think as we're closing out, like, could you say the same for yourself?
It was more of an overwhelming theme throughout the later stages of my gambling that was like, okay, if you're not a bad gambler, what are you? And I didn't know that gambling addiction was real. And so I really was left with like two options. I'm a bad gambler or I'm a failure in everything. And that theme kind of teetered between the two, right? Like sometimes I'd be like, oh, that was unlucky. Other times I'd be like, you're so stupid. And when I get the you're so stupid, that was like, gonna rip my hair out, punch a wall. Like it would trigger an incredible stint of anger. And so I can't think of one moment where I was like, I need to leave the earth. But for years, I was teetering on what is your life even worth?
And now, over 2 years in recovery, what do you think now? And you have a great, great girlfriend and life is good?
Yeah, life is good. I always like to say when I get this question, like, life isn't always good. But what happens is when we're gambling, when we're struggling through active addiction, whatever it might be, you are not only making your problems worse by like kind of multiplying the problem, but you're allowing that frame of mind that like, you're looking at the world through the lens of a gambler, that you just encounter more problems. Like, I don't know a better way of expressing that. Now, I have problems all the time, but my problems are binary. I fix them. Like, I'm hungry. I'll eat. I'm fighting with my girlfriend. I will apologize. I hope she's watching this. I will apologize. We get into an argument. But like before, it was like, I am in 6 months of debt. I can't just, okay, bang, let's be happy now. That's an active problem that continues that will cycle into more problems as I try to fix it by gambling. And so what I'll say is, like, you're basically putting down a loaded gun. You can't shoot yourself anymore. You can still stub your toe. When you stub your toe, you're not dead. You know, you got to just solve the problem. But I'd say life overall has the ability to be good, whereas before, everything was artificial.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes is, addiction is hard, recovery is hard, choose your hard. Yeah. And it's like, I would choose the hard of recovery every day, because it's like, it's a different kind of hard. And it's a hard that builds resilience, hope, all these things. Whereas addiction, the heart of addiction is just this churning cycle, and it's nothing gets better. Nothing's going to change. And so I will choose the heart of recovery every day.
Christina, thanks so much for turning the mic on me and talking about my gambling addiction story. To anyone that wants to hear more about Christina's story, I want you to check out this video of when we did her interview on this channel. Let's keep getting better together, one day at a time.